Hey everybody, welcome to this. I'm your host, Shauna Griffiths. After a hiatus, the podcast is back, folks. It is back and better. I'm infusing the leadership athlete into it, and we're having conversations, breaking down hot topics that are designed to help you take your game to the next level. So today's episode is actually the third in a series that we've been doing that focuses on breaking down revenue growth. So revenue growth is a topic that is close to me, is close to my guest, Bob Wiesner, who is my teammate at the Change Force Management Consulting Firm. So welcome to the show, Bob.
Great to be back, Shauna. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So, folks, I don't know if you missed the first two episodes of this series. The first one was winning and growing are not the same things. The second was how decision makers really think. And today's is the 13 truths of pitching. So if those of you who are listening, if you pitch a lot, which we all do, I was actually saying this earlier today, like everything is pitching. It's kind of like everything communicates. It's a good one for you to hopefully for you to listen to and take a lot of good things away from. So Bob, again, like thank you for joining us. As I've shared in the other episodes, you've had over 30 years in this space. Your clients are seeing big results from working with you in the past, and I have the joy of working with you now with our clients. So billions of dollars of revenue driven, win rates of consistently over 80%. So part of these 13 truths of pitching is part of the secret sauce that you've taught people and that we weave into our work with our clients.
Yes. And you know, like a lot of athletes, while we celebrate our wins, we really stew over our losses. Right. They stick with us and we can't understand how the hell did I lose? And I have felt that way since I started working in this pitch consulting space, about why did we lose? Why did my clients lose? Why do people who really have every credential, every reason to expect to win, why don't they? And that becomes even more important when they don't win often. So I spent maybe a disproportionate amount of time trying to understand what can go wrong in a pursuit and in a pitch. And that led to what we're today calling the 13 truths of pitching, which essentially are things that firms ought to be doing, but often are not. Or they're just not doing well enough. And if they could make that correction to now do these things differently and maybe more effectively, they would win more often.
Absolutely. And to your point about the firm, so the audience knows, we're talking about whether it's an agency, it could be a law firm, an architecture firm. And if you're listening and maybe you're not part of a firm, these are things that you with your team or you as an individual can really benefit from. Again, everything comes down to pitching. It's that conversation. How do you enter it? What is the phasing of it? So we're going to cover a laundry list, 13 truths as we're focusing on today. But you know, again, they're really designed for people to be able to put these things into action. And that's really only part of what it means to really be driving healthy growth. So I will pause on that part and just share with folks that part of how Bob and I work with people as Change Force teammates is really to step into the seat with our clients at kind of these points of whether it's friction or it's inflection. So whether something's not going very well, or it's a big moment of change that you're going through. And sometimes actually that can correlate around pitching. So either things are going well, they're not going well, there's a new dynamic around. So that is part of how we get in there, work with our clients, and then we step away and let you continue to, you know, work your magic again at that kind of next level of your game. So with all of that said, we want to jump right into these 13 truths. So I will warn you folks, you might agree with them, you might completely disagree with them, and we hope we hear from you. But so let's start up with the first one, Bob.
Well, the first fundamental truth is a sad one. And if you pardon the vernacular, it's that pitching sucks. It's a lousy way to grow your revenue. And that, of course, requires a little explanation. So let me just spend a moment on this. First of all, when you're in pitch mode, you almost automatically have little or no control over the communication, over the relationship, over the really getting to know each other. We talk about, Shauna, about the exacerbation of blind spots. The typical pitch, and it really doesn't matter, as you said, what profession you're in, is usually this regimented, right? It's regulated. So there are rules. How often can you talk to the client? How long can that conversation be? What are you able to ask them? What are you not able to ask them? What will they tell you? What will they not tell you? But it's all for some reason lost in antiquity. This is sort of the way pitching is done. We just can't really get to know each other and really get to understand what all is required of both of us, both the pitching party and the decision makers. You know, pitching does require a lot of resources, resources that in most organizations, especially SMB size organizations, have to be devoted to other things. They're not full-time pitchers. They're also working on client business. It can drain your resources. Your culture gets impacted by it. There's all kinds of stuff that can happen. So if you think that in order to grow your revenue, we have to pitch more often, okay, that's just asking for a lot of heartache, ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll go into this a bit later, but I love that element that you talk about. Like, it's actually not about pitching more, you know, which is so contrary to what so many people find, get on that hamster wheel of pitch. So again, folks, first truth, pitching sucks. And you know what's worse? Number two, pitching sucks more, when you're losing. So give us the intel on that part, Bob.
Yeah, so nobody likes losing, but nobody bats 1,000 in baseball or, you know, hits 100% of their three-point shots. So you're going to lose occasionally, and that's okay. But there's a philosophy, maybe it's a mindset that a lot of firms have, which is that you got to be in it to win it, right? And it's okay to lose. And maybe by losing, I've gotten a beachhead established and I've begun to form a relationship. But when you lose, even if it's infrequently, but certainly if it's frequently, then you're too many losses. And with all these losses, what's potentially happening is that you're damaging your reputation. Mm. You know, you may be seen by the prospect who rejected you as a viable alternative, and we're really glad we got to know these guys. Or you may be seen by that prospect as a loser. Mm. You know, well, we invited them in. They didn't do a really good job, or they maybe parenthetically, they did a great job, but the decision makers didn't like them enough to hire them. So now your potentially first exposure to your prospect is as a loser in a pitch. Mm. And I'm hard pressed to understand, you know, why that's too often a good thing. If you pitch very often, especially if you lose, it has an impact on morale. It has an impact on energy. You and I have talked a lot about energy, how limited it is and how important it is to be allocated in a very thoughtful way. And honestly, there are some senior leaders of firms who in their most honest moments will admit that they have, they suffer from what we call pitch addiction.
Yeah.
When the invitation comes in, when the RFP or RFQ arrives, they just can't say no. Yeah. Maybe there's a rationale behind it. Maybe it's all emotional, but put it all together and too much pitching can oftentimes lead to too much losing. Shauna, when you and I work with clients, our goal is to get them to pitch less and win more.
Yeah,
and that's the opposite side of this coin. And that's a whole separate webinar, perhaps, or a conversation that maybe we'll have with some folks that are listening. Pitch less, win more. And you'll get through the first two of 13 truths with flying colors.
Yeah, absolutely. And that path to winning, it's not, it doesn't, there's key moments in what helps us to win versus to lose, and that leads us right into that number three, which is all about that 10 minutes to win and 2 hours to lose. So help the audience really get a grasp of what do we mean by that?
This really plays to the psychology of decision making, especially the way very senior decision makers operate. They are forming judgments very quickly when they see a team in front of them delivering a pitch or being interviewed to handle a matter. And the way most firms go about pitching, the first 10 minutes of every pitch is identical from firm to firm. What do you do in the first 10 minutes? You introduce yourselves. You talk about some of your credentials, where your offices are, how many professionals you have, your client list, the awards you've won. And remember, in a pitch, we've talked about this before, the decision makers are seeing five or six firms coming in a 1 or 2 week period, and they all sound the same in the first 10 minutes. You think you sound different, but you don't. So they're making up their minds really early whether they want to hire you or not. On the flip side of this is the opportunity to take those first 10 minutes when they are forming very strong opinions about you and use it to your advantage. Give them something to grasp onto, give them a perspective, an insight, give them something really awesome to give them a reason to keep listening to you for the next hour and 20 minutes. There's one conversation, Shauna, that you and I have had with our clients over the years. I know many, many times. And it has to do with the concept of drama. Well, I don't want to, reveal anything too soon at the beginning because I want to build up to it. And I understand that if, we were writing a TV show, and somebody was making a commitment to watch 10 episodes. But that's not this. These are senior people. They don't want their time wasted. So in the first 10 minutes, give them something unique, something highly relevant, and most importantly, something about them, not about you, the pitching team. And that gives you a better chance of winning.
I get such a great point. And for those of you who are listening, if you actually think about what does it typically look like when you go into a pitch or you hear about pitches again, a lot of times that first 10 minutes, people feel like, oh, I'm just going to kind of get warmed up. And we'll have a little bit of, as you saw me post yesterday, small chat, small talk. That's not so again, it's like saying, how do you shift that, take a different approach to those are really meaningful first 10 minutes around them. Again, they're forming judgments, they're listening to you. But at the same time, again, if what happens a lot of times is those first 10 minutes is just p like the pitch team introducing themselves. That doesn't really give the decision makers that hook, as Bob is talking about. That hook to like dive deeper into the wormhole. So if you really think about it, that first 10 minutes is all about like getting that hook out, getting them to start to dive into that, your wormhole, which is the rest of your that time that you have with those decision makers.
Yes, and I'm not at all suggesting that you should not introduce yourselves,
Correct.
or give a couple of minutes about your firm, your background, why you deserve to be in the room here. But I'm talking a couple of minutes. If you think about, and I ask all the listeners here to go back and do a review of your pitches. What did you do in the first 10 minutes? Well, you introduced the team, you talked about your firm, then you probably went through an agenda for what you're going to talk about today in the meeting. And then you probably, as you got to minutes maybe 7, 8, 9, or 8, 9, and 10, you recapped the objectives that they told you they wanted. You went through the parameters that they, the client, gave you. So, which everyone else is going to do anyway. So after 10 minutes, you've done nothing to pique their interest. You've done nothing to show your any original thinking, any dedication and devotion or passion about their business. All you've done is you spouted out stuff that they could find either in their own RFP or by going to your website. So when we say 10 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes about yourself, okay, and then get right into what matters to them, what they care about. And now now the hook has been baited, and now you got a chance of making the rest of the pitch really, really special for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said, it's about like, what is that? Partly is about what's that insight. And to your point also is you're actually showing them that you're passionate about their business, about what they care about. So again, I think those are some points that you said that I'm just putting some exclamation points on for the audience to listen. Those are, again, those are just some really key moments within that first 10 minutes. So we're going to move on to number four. So I'm going to let you lead with number four.
Ah, you're a coward, are you? You're scared about this one.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. I'll take responsibility for it. And I'm going to use that word coward. This is a generalization, and I don't want to get, you know, nasty tweets and direct messages from people, but it's a way of orienting yourself as you put the pitch together. And this truth, number four, says that clients are cowards. Now, here's what we mean about it. Let me substantiate what I'm saying. Many of us in every profession have at one time or another, and maybe on many occasions, we've gotten RFPs from clients who say, we're not looking for the same old thing. We want a different idea, a different approach. We're interested in innovation. You want someone who can take us into places that we're not even comfortable going. You've gotten those requests. You've pitched to those requests, and then they've hired one of the usual suspects. They've safe hired bet. A firm that represents a safe choice, a more politically correct choice in some cases. And I don't mean that in the PC way. I mean politically correct, meaning that internally on the client side, the bosses won't get upset.
Right.
By trying to stretch them too far. So look, the reason that this happens too is that clients are evaluated based on results. Mm-hmm. Okay. They have to hire somebody who has to help them generate outcomes that helps the client be judged as successful, help them at best get a raise, get promoted, get equity in their company. At worst, at least they keep their jobs. Okay. They're very political beings. So they, you know, to think that they might be 100% sincere about their quest for something completely different and outside the box thinking really does require at best a little skepticism, right? There's one more point, Sean, that I want to make on this one too, which many firms lose sight of. They're pitching to an RFP. An RFP states that we're looking for something different, something innovative. In many instances, the RFP was not issued by the senior decision makers. It was issued by somebody lower down in the organization, maybe someone in a completely different department. We've seen instances multiple times where RFPs were not even read by senior decision makers. They know it existed, but they were going to have their own rationale for making a hiring decision. So once again, you have to be aware that you're pitching to people. You're not pitching to a piece of paper as an RFP. And those people are going to act like people do. And this is one area where you can bet you might be seeing some real differences between what they say and what they actually will do.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we've said about in some of the previous episodes, and as you and I talk about in general, this is part of why it's so important to do everything you can to get to know the person that you're pitching to find out as much information as possible, because they do have these tendencies. And, you know, to your point, it's human behavior, right? There's a sense of like that comes out of a sense of fear is why there's that element of cowardness that comes into it. So again, folks, as controversial as it may sound, clients can be cowards. But you also talked about there is that, you know, like business impact and measuring. So that goes right to the fifth one, that business impact really matters. So part of what we're saying to people is that you really do need to push the person that you're working with, that decision maker, for what are those metrics? What are the measurements that they're going to hold it to?
Yeah, you need to know as a pitching organization how the decision makers themselves are being measured. What will affect their compensation? What will affect their career, at least within that company? And that's really what you're pitching to, because they're ultimately hiring your firm, whether you're in Marcom or architecture or management consulting or investment banking, law, you're being hired to get results for them. And those results are more than just solving the matter or putting up a building or building an ad campaign. Their results are that they're measured on are how many boxes of detergent did you sell? How many new enrollments did we have in our university? Or how many new applications did we have? Did we improve our standing with the community? What did this resolution, how did this affect our stock price, our shareholder value? These are ultimately how they're being measured. They would like to hire a firm that understands that and can help them connect the solution that you're going to be showing them and ultimately providing with those actual outcomes that really matter most to them. As soon as you build that into the pitch, you're suddenly very different from the other guys, much more relevant and likely much more attractive to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the important things, you talked a little bit earlier about the people that you're pitching to, and then they have bosses. So the reality is that a lot of times they need the people that you're pitching to actually have to go and justify to the people that they're reporting to why they want to pick you. Look at, and again, what we're saying about the business impact matters is because you want the person who's advocating for you as the person who's going to win the pitch, you want them to be saying like, here's what they're going to do for our business. And then as you go along, if you do win that business, then you have to actually back that up. You have to drive those results and then continue to feed that to your clients so that they can again advocate for you. So again, it doesn't, we're talking about things that are very much need to be integrated into the pitch that then become part of the relationship.
Most definitely. Most definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get on to number six, Bob. Consumer insights matter.
Well, we can actually stretch this out a little bit, Shauna.
Okay.
Because consumer insights are obviously relevant for somebody who's going to be communicating to the consumer. But we're really talking more broadly about the value of insights in a pitch. And that's especially how they connect to the previous truth. Mm-hmm. If I'm promising you business outcomes, it's the insights that I have about your problem, about your situation, about your market that give you confidence that I both understand the outcomes that you want and that I can help you achieve them. Now, if you're in an area in which the ultimate deliverable that you'll be hired to develop is going to be seen by the consumer, such as in advertising, Marcom, arguably also in architecture, arguably also in other areas of design, then you can talk consumer, certainly. Mm-hmm. What do you understand about the user of the product or service that you're pitching for, right? If it's a more B2B kind of a situation, if it's more of a, if it's a consultancy, perhaps a law firm, you still have insights about the issues, about the challenges, the opportunities, about competitors, about financials, about politics. All of these things need to be pushed higher up in the sequence of the pitch and need to take a much bigger role in most of your pitches so that you can, with a higher degree of trust and confidence, convince that prospect that you actually do understand what matters to them. As we've talked about in one of our previous sessions together with your listeners, we talked about how important it is in decision-making for the decision makers to hire a firm who really understands what those decision makers are looking for. Your insights into their situation are so vital to elevating that score of understands me. So don't discount them. In fact, make them bigger and push them up in sequence so that they shout loud and clear to the decision makers.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So once we've established those things, how is it that you're going to be in that pitch, and what are the things that you're going to focus on to really turn that conversation? If it's not number seven is, which is about creative, it's not being all about creative. It's not thinking that creative is the be all and end all, because the seventh truth is creative might not matter.
Yeah. And again, we can broaden this because we know we have different professions that are watching us today, listening to us. This really, the word creative is really a stand-in for the idea of your solution.
Right.
Whatever you've been asked to recommend, you've been to show us how you would solve the problem is exactly the kind of thing that often comes up. Tell us what this might look like when we hire you. What will it look like when you deliver it to us? Now, if you're a MarCom, then you understand the concept of creative. If you're an architecture, you understand that concept. But almost any profession is oftentimes asked for, what will you deliver to us if we hire you? Now, this is important, but it's in our experience and in our analysis, it's far less important than pitching firms think it is. Okay. A lot of pitching firms think that they're going to win because the decision maker will see that they have the best solution, right? If you talk to the decision makers, though, what they're going to say is, yeah, we, you know, your solution seemed okay, but we weren't confident you could pull it off. We weren't certain it was going to work. It seemed a little too, it didn't seem rational enough to us. What your the solution actually is in a pitch is it's proof, we call it proof of concept, okay? It's proof that you can actually deliver something against their ultimate objectives, in other words, the results that they want to achieve, using the insights that you have about their situation and their market. Combine those two together, here's a look at what we might do for you. So it's proof that you're actually able to do something. Now, as a lot of us know who have been in and around these businesses, we can show a solution, but once we get hired, they're going to go with something. They're going to ask us to start from scratch anyway.
Yeah.
Right. You know, we accept that, and that doesn't seem to bother us that much. So there's no reason not to have a similar sort of approach to your pitch. And this, again, comes to the idea of energy and resources, right? We see too many firms that place too much of their energy and too many of the resources against developing the perfect solution. Whereas I would rather they put that, you know, a little less energy to develop the perfect solution, maybe just enough energy to get a good solution, because a lousy solution is going to lose the pitch no matter what. Get a good solution, and then take your energy reserves and put them into selling that solution, wrapping it inside the insights, showing the rationale for how it's going to achieve the outcomes, using those extra ergs to get a better understanding of what matters to the decision makers. That's reallocation sometimes can make a huge difference in how you think about and ultimately deliver a winning pitch.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the point of, and why I positioned it at first as I did, is like, well, what do you pay attention to, or what do you double down on if it's not all about the creative idea, the solution, the perfect solution? And folks, I said that because you may be hearing that being like, what are you talking about? It's got to be the perfect thing. It's got to be beautiful. It's got to be, but here's the thing, what you're actually trying to do is show them how you think, how you would attempt, how you would approach something. And that's why Bob was talking about, you want to look at what are the insights, how are you bringing that to bear, how are you showing them that you'll come up with a solution, and that you're nimble, and that you're able to be adaptable, adapt to changes on their side, adapt to changes in the marketplace. So again, it's what we're saying here is creative may not actually matter as much as you think it does. So think about how are you approaching it. Think about how you can show them and win them over with that. Win them over with how you would approach it and how you think. And then that is part of then what you actually then said was about spend that time a bit differently. So actually, Bob, what you were talking about is what points to the next number eight truth is about stories. Stories count. That's that wrapping it up in a bow in that delivery.
Yeah, this is not news to a lot of you, because if you have been trying to understand communication and how best to register points and be persuasive and be memorable, then somewhere along the line, you've come across this concept that too much data, too much analytics just doesn't seem to work as well as we think it does. However, storytelling, and it's been 25 or 30 years since Robert McKee, wrote his treatise in Harvard Business Review about storytelling in business applications. And you should Google that. Robert McKee is McKee. It's been, I think now, pretty well established that I need less data, less analytics in my pitch, and more stories, because people remember stories. Mm. People remember, rather than, and by the way, you've seen this over and over again in other fields. You see it in politics. Us old timers remember Joe the plumber. we don't need a story. We don't need to hear that 19% of people are living at or below the poverty line or whatever horrible number or statistic it actually is. But we're really touched when we meet a family mm-hmm. who's been affected by that. We remember stories, morals, individuals, how things impacted them. So take your data and your analytics. And instead of throwing chart after chart and table after table onto slides, summarize it into really interesting stories that capture the meaning that you're trying to communicate with that data. Furthermore, think of stories not just in that micro basis, which is extraordinarily important, but think of it on a macro basis also. Your entire pitch should be a story. Okay, to go back to a TV analogy, if you're writing if you're a showrunner for a program, an 8-episode program that's going to go on to a streamer, the first thing you do is you create your story arc, right? So you know what's going to be happening over the course of 8 episodes, how you're going to start, middle, and end that story. Each individual episode then contributes to the ultimate story, right? Gets the viewer to the end state. Your pitch has to be constructed the same way. Each individual presenter is, in a sense, telling an episode within that single story that the pitch is trying to communicate. When that happens, when you're all in sync that way, it's a thing of beauty. And decision makers get it. They understand how well you're coordinated, how well you think alike. And your pitch becomes both persuasive and memorable and not just a sound alike to the other 5 competitors in the pursuit.
Right. And I'm glad you said that again, because I was actually going to kind of like lean back to that, which is exactly that. You're memorable. You want to be memorable in that room that day. So that's part of how you pull that off, how you pull that storytelling. That's what they're literally going to remember later. That's how you stand out from others who are going to be in there, to your point, just showing graphs. I love that. That's what you pointed to, that I was going to say analogy, I don't know if that's the right word, but of like, what's the 12% of poverty, but they actually remember when you tell a story about a family who's affected from it. So that's a great one for, I think, the listeners to take away. That's the difference that we're talking about here. Which actually, again, brings us to the next one. I love how these are leading right into the next ones, Bob. But the next one, the 9, is it's a performance. Right? So it is, if you're storytelling, if each one of the pitch team members is telling an episode, then folks, it is a performance.
Correct. And it doesn't mean you have to have acting skills, nope. But you really need to be well prepared. Mm-hmm. Clients can discern what we in the business call your level of intention or your intentionality. Did you put time and effort into this? Did you really care? Do we, the client, really matter to you? Now, it's quite possible, in fact, it's quite probable that leading up to the pitch date, you put tons of effort into this and you really did care about the benefit of the client as well as winning. However, how many of you in the audience, raise your hands, if you feel that you rehearse enough for your final pitch? Ah, I can see that. There's a lot of honesty out there in our audience, Shauna. So few firms put enough time into rehearsal, into that kind of, that level of preparation. So few firms work on the chemistry that's going to be in the room as each presenter from the pitch team is working with each other, is handing off to each other, is coordinating their answers to questions, is working through timing issues and so on. That's what the client sees. They don't see as easily as you'd like them to the work you did leading up to that day. What they see is what's being delivered to them in those 90 minutes. That's the performance that we're talking about. So rehearse, build your timeline so you have time to rehearse. Make sure that everyone is on the same page and how you're going to be approaching things in what we call the choreography that's going to take place in the room, that your slides all look great, that you're all able to control them well. And all of that, if done well, will help you win. If done poorly, will overwhelm all the good thinking that you've put into getting to that stage.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, again, to your point, that's what we mean when we say performance. It's, are you organized? How do you pull it off in the room that day? You know? And again, it's so much, the importance actually is not about performativeness. I'm using air quotes, as far as being fake. Actually, that's what gets into number, our 10th truth, is that it's not about being fake. It's actually all about being authentic. Fake doesn't usually win to win. It doesn't usually lead to winning, but that authenticity that comes through when you have, you know, again, like you've infused that into the performance, that storytelling, pulling that off in the room that day, that's where you start to see and really grasp the decision makers in the room that day.
It is so true that people don't want to hire something different than what they've seen in the room. Right? They want to hire the authentic team, the real people. So be real, be yourself. You may have to be the best version of yourself,
Good call.
But we at Change Force would never try to change you into something you're not. We would just try to make sure that your best, most and authentic version is the one that people see. You know, authenticity is, it's hard to fake it. And that actually comes through. If you are faking, people will know it. They'll know that's not you. There's a false thinking that you and I, Shauna, run into in coaching our clients. And it's articulated by people who don't want to rehearse. Yeah. Because they say that if I rehearse, I'll sound rehearsed.
Right.
I'd rather go in without rehearsal so I can be myself. And now I do understand where they're coming from, but I respectfully disagree. Rehearsal is more about being prepared. Are you going to be able to say what you want to say in the manner in which you want to say it? You don't have to memorize a script or act it out. It's really just being ready. Furthermore, are you going to be able to handle the curveballs that are going to be thrown at you when you have less time than you thought you were going to have? When someone shows up who wasn't expected to be there on the client side, or doesn't show up who was expected to be there? When the equipment's not working properly? When you get a question out of left field that may be dumb, but you have to answer it anyway? So preparation and rehearsal is not designed to make you look artificial or fake. It's designed to make sure that you are as positively, genuinely authentic as you possibly can.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad you said that. I can't even tell you the when the lack of rehearsals that I've witnessed, you know, when I've worked in places, when I've, you know, I know other people obviously who are parts of firms, and there is just a, it's just that emphasis isn't there. That's the, I think one of the first thing that goes out the window in pitching is that preparation. I mean, I can't tell you the number of pitches I've been a part of where you've got people, you know, flying in that morning, they haven't looked at the deck yet, you're sitting over coffee or breakfast, and they're still making changes to the deck. Like, let me tell you, folks who are listening to this, that is all such, that energy really can cause so much disruption that is literally the opposite of preparedness. So, you know, those are the kind of things we're talking about, is that level of preparation, rehearsing. Those are the things that allow you to really stand in your strength and just be authentic in the moment, be adaptive, be, you know, resilient in the room when things aren't working. Again, it's like you want to minimize the variables. There's not a lot that you can control a lot sometimes in those rooms. So you want to do everything you can that you have. You've covered the controllables that you can in advance.
Sure. You know, I think athletes can relate to this quite easily. The saying, and I don't know whether this came from, I believe it came from Gary Player, the famous golfer mm-hmm. from several decades ago. If any listeners know the source of this quote, please drop it into the comments. But my recollection is that it was Gary Player who said that when I practice, I discover my mistakes during practice. Uh-huh. If I don't practice, I discover my mistakes during the match.
Yeah.
You'd much rather discover your mistakes during rehearsal and fix them before you're in front of the client. So you and I are dedicated to the idea of taking our clients and putting them in a position where they are both willing and able to rehearse, and they get the most value from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think it's one of the things where we're like, are you serious? Do I really need to do that? I don't know how to fit that into the time period that we have. Again, folks, we can't stress enough how important it is that that's part of the preparation. So let's get to these last. We have three more. So I'm going to let you lead the way with the 11th as well.
Yeah, so this goes hand in hand with the concept of the importance of rehearsal. We could call number 11 the weakest link concept. But the terminology we officially use for this is that everyone is special or no one is special. That may be a reinterpretation of a line from The Incredibles, I think. But everyone is special or no one is special absolutely matters in new business pitching. Your team is only going to be as viewed as strong as the weakest presenter on the team. Now, that doesn't mean everybody has to be five-star presenters, but it means that everybody has to be prepared. Everybody has to be on the same page. I made this comment earlier, but you have to have very smooth handoffs and transitions. You have to use similar formats. There are so many pitches that I've been involved with, and this was very much the case when I worked with the largest firms in their categories, the largest ad agencies, the largest accounting firms, where some senior person would say, I don't need to rehearse. I'm just going to show up and do my thing. You know, I've got it all figured out. I do this all the time. And what happens is that they wind up presenting something that might be out of sync with the rest of the pitch, certainly is going to be misaligned with the previous presenter and the following presenter. And oftentimes the pitch team winds up sitting there kind of aghast at, what did they just say? Did they really say that? And that's a huge problem. The client fixed that up.
I'm having PTSD as you're saying it. I can't tell you how many times. Again, I feel like I've said this a few times during this. Like, can't tell you how many times. But I've been in the room when these things happen, where the person literally says those words. I'm just going to come and do my thing. I do this all the time. I'm good. And they come in and you're sitting there. It's like you have secondhand embarrassment. You know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like I said at the beginning, as athletes, you know, we remember our losses more than maybe sometimes more than our wins. And I remember a pitch I worked on as a consultant with an agency, and they lost the pitch. And the feedback they got from the client was that you had this one for the first 80% or 90% of the pitch until the agency leader started to speak. And as soon as they started to speak, we realized all the reasons why we did not want to hire you. And that's because this agency leader had come in and told the rest of the team, "I've got this covered. Don't worry." My mother used to say when I would say to her, "Don't worry," she would say famous last words.
That's the most painful thing to be sitting through. The person comes in and does that, and you just want to zip it.
So here's the deal. You got to rehearse this as a team. Yep. Make sure that every player has a meaningful part to deliver, so no one is there, and the client's going to wonder why was they there? Why were they there? I don't understand the contribution they're going to make. Yeah. So everyone has a meaningful part. They're well rehearsed, and that's all you need. But that's not a little bit. That's a lot. If you get to that stage where everyone in the pitch team is really delivering at a really good, strong level, you have a much better chance of winning.
Yeah, everybody has a role, right? Everybody's on the squad. You have to, all the sports analogies, but it really is so true. And, you know, this number 12 is, we're going to go right on to, which is that pitching is your day job. Again, kind of a thing that happens a lot of times where things can get off track. Where these pitches are done and, you know, it's your night job, it's your before job, it's your weekend job. And talk about that with us, if you will, and kind of the ripple effect of that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's inevitable with many of the firms who have people listening to us talk about this, where they're saying, well, look, we have clients and, you know, when we do pitches, it's an add-on to what we currently do. And we totally understand that. And that's one of the reasons why we say pitching sucks and pitch less to win more. But if you do agree to take on a pitch, you're going to have to put the time into it. Yeah. And it's not because we say you need to do it. It's because the client will perceive whether or not you did put the time in. Right. I used a term earlier called intentionality or intention. Mm-hmm. And that's comes through in every pursuit. And it plays a bigger role than you think it does in the final decision making. So put the time into it. Now, some firms think that I can compensate for the fact that I have a day job and I don't have the time to put together a big pitch by having off the shelf content, right? Well, that off the shelf content may save you time, but it'll start to look like a cookie cutter pitch. And your prospect is going to be able to tell which of the competing firms trotted out the same material that they had given the previous week to another client versus which firm really thought about that unique client in a unique way and had a specific perspective to offer. You know, only the truly willing will thrive in pitching, the truly willing. So if you're going to take on a pitch, do it when you have the time and the energy, the resources to do it. Go all in for it, but don't pitch very often because you can't go all in all the time. And if you don't go all in, those are the pitches that where your likelihood of losing is far greater.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've worked in the advertising and the marketing agency space so much. And so I've been involved where there's filters for the filters that we're going to use to decide if we're going to go for the pitch. But very rarely have I seen people put in, is it realistic in the time frame? That can mm-hmm. we actually do this and deliver a pitch at the standard of excellence that we need to uphold? You know, again, it's that a lot of times that just goes to the wayside and it just is like, oh, we'll figure it out. We'll figure out how we get it done. But again, you know, in the very beginning, you talked about we're actually setting up the person that we're pitching to. That's how they are now going to start thinking about us. That's how you step away. That's the impression they have of your team. So again, it's like you want to be able to control what you can control going into it, the preparation, the rehearsing, all of those things is for how you show up in the room that day. Again, so I really think it's important to think of that as one of the filters to even decide if you are going to pitch. Can't pitch at everything.
No doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to round out the last one. Give us the last one, Bob. Lucky number 13.
Yeah. And I sum this up this way. Pitch to win, rules are for losers. Now, this will be, along with a couple others, I think the most controversial comment that we'll make. And if you don't buy it, I understand. And it's a generality, by the way, because there are plenty of pitches where if you don't follow the rules, you'll immediately be eliminated, no matter how qualified, insightful, appropriate you are. However, we have to remember that in a real pitch, you have the best chance of winning when you can strut your stuff. And more importantly, perhaps, when the client can strut their stuff. When we eliminate those blind spots that I referred to earlier that are inevitably baked into highly regulated, orchestrated pitch processes, when those blind spots are gone, we really can build a relationship. We can get to know each other. Not only do I have a better chance of winning, not only does the decision maker have a better chance of choosing me, but because we have gotten to know each other so well, we'll get off to a faster start when we're finally hired. And perhaps by getting to know each other better during the pitch process, we, the competing firm, can make a better decision about whether we should even be pitching. Oh, now that I get to know these guys, I realize they talk out of both sides of their mouth. Or they're not as committed to innovation as I thought they were going to be. Or they're not openly communicating with us as much as we're openly communicating with them. You'll start to see some yellow and even some red flags around whether this is a client that we should have, no less whether we're a firm that they should hire. And when the rules prevent you from doing that, then you it's just not a good pitch to be participating in. So look for opportunities to stretch the rules. Look for opportunities to have more conversations, to reveal more information, to ask more questions. You want to pitch to the real needs, the real issues and challenges, not just to the RFP. And if you're going to be totally prohibited from varying from the RFP completely, then that may be a really good pitch not to bother participating in.
Yeah, absolutely. I love how you stress that. It's both ways, right? They're deciding if they want to hire you, but it's also you need to decide, do we actually want this client? Do we want this work? And again, I think if people are hearing this, they're like, well, that's easy to say theoretically, or yeah, right. Again, it's kind of the quicker you can weed out the ones that you don't want to spend that time and resources, then you have time freed up to cultivate relationships, to create new opportunities, to find the one that is meant for you. So again, there's, you know, the damage that can be done by taking on a client that's out of your bullseye rings, that, you know, that you're not really set up for success for, it can just have a ton of ripple effects. So all of these truths are, again, meant for you listeners to be able to take them, consider them, please give us your feedback, and then start to put some stuff into practice, test it out. We would love to hear from you. So please take a moment to comment, to connect with us on LinkedIn, send us a message if you'd like to. But you know, our goal is to help set you all up for success as you continue your journey and as you're leading other people in your journeys. So thank you all so much. And Bob, thank you so much for joining again today for our third episode in the series.
It's fun as usual, Shauna, and a pleasure. And thank you for the opportunity to do this. I would, like you, I wish our listeners and our viewers the best success, and let us know if we can help.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Have an awesome day.